Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Fire Marshal's Corner on Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamel, and we have a great show this month. We have a very full show this month that we're going to have for you. We're starting with Representative Langevin, who's going to be talking about the Fire Sprinkler Incentive Act that's been introduced in Congress. Then we're going to move on to Jeff Shapiro, who's going to fill us in on residential sprinklers and the code change that's coming up at the ICC hearing in May. Fire Marshal Lambert from the National Association of State Fire Marshals is going to talk about their educational theme for this month, which is spring cleaning, clean your ductwork. John Dragenberg from Underwriters Laboratories is going to talk about the E85 or the ethanol dispensing systems, which is a really hot issue across the country right now. And then we're going to wrap it up with a great presentation or a great conversation with Sean Longrich from the People's Burn Foundation of Indiana that's going to talk about some of the fantastic programs and very innovative programs that they're doing out there. So with that, let's get right into the show. Joining us right now is Ray Lambert, who is the State Fire Marshal from North Dakota, and he also serves on the National Association of State Fire Marshals Educational Committee. And each month we're going to be focusing on a theme. NASFAM has an educational theme each month, and the theme for this month is spring cleaning. Clean out your dryer lint and ductwork. And Fire Marshal Lambert, you know, I'll have to admit that this is something that, quite honestly, I don't think about a lot, and I guess it is a problem, though. So I appreciate you joining us, and maybe you can fill us in a little bit on it.
Yes, it is. You know, cleaning out dryer vents or around and underneath and behind dryers is not on the thing to do list for today for a lot of people. And it is, and it has been a cause of many fires. It's not one of our top leading causes, but it certainly hits the scales, and it is very much a preventable fire if proper care and maintenance is provided.
I guess a lot of people don't really understand just that, you know, lint is pretty combustible. I mean, it's a light, fluffy material with a lot of surface area that if it's ignited, it can just really take off pretty good, can it?
It does build up in the back air flow vents of the dryer and, of course, the extension ductwork from the dryer to the outsides. There's many different type dryer vents ducting available. And depending on the type vent material you have installed in your home, you could be placing yourself more susceptible to a larger accumulation of lint buildup. And, you know, typically the plastic collapsible coiled wire vents does have a tendency to collect more lint than the metal clean interior straight duct working.
So you're talking about the rigid kind of ductwork?
The rigid would be certainly less susceptible to accumulation of lint.
And I'd have to imagine this certainly is not a problem just in the residential area, but also in the large commercial occupancies where they're really running, you know, the dryers far more continuously. You must get a tremendous buildup in those if you don't clean them out on a regular basis.
That can be true. Commercial operations usually have in the part of the country in the North Country here that I serve in, they're very familiar with the lint issue and the amount of drying and laundry that goes through their operations. So they're pretty well attuned to, if not in the house, commercial cleaners to come in to clean their their equipment out on a regular basis.
Now, when the lint does ignite, is this something that it ignites because of the dryer as the ignition source, or is there something else that tends to be the ignition source, and this just serves as the fuel?
The ignition source typically is the dryer. That is where the heat is being generated. And, you know, of course, the lint build up, the closer to the dryer element, the heating elements themselves, the more susceptible to fire. Some common problems that we have encountered here in North Dakota, and I'll just mention, and that is the flexible type hose. Where you would have a need for a 3-foot section of hose, you'd buy a 12-foot section and just wrap it or overlap it itself behind the dryer. Of course, extending the travel to vent. And every time you bend it or overlap it, of course, then you've got a corner to turn, which is, susceptible to a larger accumulation of lint buildup, as well as these vent materials themselves are combustible and will burn. Mm-hmm. So anytime you're restricting the flow or you start to restrict the flow of air from the dryer, of course, the more heat this dryer does generate, and it will generate temperatures to the degree that it will ignite lint that is built up in these vent tubes. And of course, once that occurs, then it quickly spreads from the vent tube to the structure, unfortunately.
Now, do you find too that a lot of times the laundry will be set up in a room that doesn't have a smoke detector in it because of the problem with the smoke alarm being activated needlessly? So these may very well be areas that just don't have the detection in it to give you the early warning.
That too is very true. Most laundry rooms are in locations, and I think we all would agree, they're somewhat noisy. So most people have them behind closed doors. They're not standing there watching them for the 45-minute hour drying cycle they run. So you have a dryer that's behind closed doors. Ignition of a fire doesn't necessarily get noticed right away, and the spread of the fires, by the time they are noticed or it reaches a room that has a smoke detector, it's a well-developed fire.
Yeah. Are you seeing the same problem up there? And I'm sure you are in North Dakota, that we're seeing elsewhere across the country, that just so many of these smoke alarms, either A, they don't have them, or even worse, they have them in place, but they just don't have the batteries in them, which is just the same as not having them. I'm sure you're having probably the same issues up there that everybody else is.
That's a tragic fact that you're talking about there. And, many homes do not have smoke detectors. It's unfortunate to say that, of all the programs we have to support that. And even on top of that, we find in North Dakota particularly, far above the numbers that don't have them, they have them, but they're inoperative, either by, the batteries have been removed or they just have not been tested and checked, and they've been hanging there, and they just flat don't work.
Yeah, that's pretty frustrating, I'm sure, when you go into take a look at a fire, especially a fatal one, and then you just find the smoke detector there just dead, when it could have given them that early warning they need to get up and get out.
Well, our statistics in North Dakota certainly puts the fire death numbers in that 75-80% plus category of homes that do not have working smoke detectors.
Yeah, that's just so sad. And it's just something that's so frustrating too, because no matter how much we all seem to talk about it, just the message seems to have a hard time getting through to the people that just really need it. Well, we've been talking with North Dakota State Fire Marshal Ray Lambert, and he's also a member of the NASFAM Educational Committee, and he's been talking about the theme for this month, which is NASFAM's educational theme of spring cleaning, clean your dryers and the duct work because of the buildup and lint in there, which is something that a lot of people don't think about but can create a very serious fire that goes undetected until it just reaches the structure. And we really appreciate you taking the time and joining us on Fire Marshal's Corner here today.
Well, thank you.
Joining us today on Fire Marshal's Corner is Congressman Langevin, who is from the Rhode Island Congressional District, 2nd Congressional District. Thank you for taking the time to join us, Congressman.
Ed, thank you very much. Great to be with you today.
The Congressman has introduced a great piece of legislation, House Resolution 17, House Bill 1742, the Fire Sprinkler Incentive Act. And, Congressman, I was wondering if you could just take a few moments to fill us in on what this legislation is all about.
Sure. Well, this legislation is designed to offer tax incentives for property owners to retrofit buildings with automatic fire sprinkler systems. I first introduced this legislation in the 108th Congress, and again in the 109th and now the 110th Congress. Originally, it was introduced with my partisan, this effort, Congressman Kerr Weldon from Pennsylvania. He is no longer in the Congress, but we're moving ahead with the bill and in his absence. And it's an important piece of legislation. It originally came out of in result of the Station nightclub fire that actually happened in my district back about 3 years ago. And unfortunately, we lost 100 lives in that fire, and 200 were seriously injured. And clearly, this accident, this terrible tragedy, this fire could have been prevented, and lives could have been saved if sprinklers were present in the building and operational.
Can you tell me a little bit about what this bill will do? I understand it offers a tax break or a tax incentive for people that install sprinklers?
That's right. The legislation would reduce the tax depreciation time for non-residential real property from 39 years to only 5 years for those that install the sprinklers. In Rhode Island, under Rhode Island law, it's law now that you have to, it's mandatory, you have to install these sprinklers in these public locations, with its businesses, restaurants or bars and such, nightclubs. But business owners truly want to do the right thing. We all recognize the tremendous benefits of having a fire sprinkler installed, but it is costly, and businesses need help in order to do this. And I think it's the right thing to do to offer this this tax incentive, this tax depreciation time, again, moving it, allowing property owners to depreciate the cost from, instead of 39 years, it would reduce to only 5 years, over which they could depreciate the cost.
Now, you mentioned that you've introduced it in two previous Congresses, and that's not really unusual for a bill to take a number of sessions to make it through, is it?
No, it's not unusual at all. You know, we all want these things done yesterday, and especially, you know, when you've got a very good idea that just is, it just makes so much sense, and you'd like to see it done yesterday. But unfortunately, the legislative process takes time. You know, you've got to convince your colleagues. There are other priorities that are pressing in the Congress, as you can imagine, and especially with the war in Iraq and the state of education and health care. So a lot of priorities, but this is an important priority as well, and we continue to press on. And, you know, we're gathering more and more momentum with each year that goes by, and I expect that in the very near future, hopefully this year, this bill will pass.
And there's a companion bill in the Senate as well, isn't there?
I believe there is a companion bill in the Senate this time that's working its way through. And again, I think it's an issue that has broad bipartisan support. It makes so much sense to have this incentive put in place. And recognizing the fact that statistics show from fire officials that in situations where sprinklers have been present, there's no recorded incidents of more than a loss of life, more than two people in a fire situation with sprinklers, an operational sprinkler system was in place. And I think that speaks volumes, and you just think of the lives that could have been saved both here on Rhode Island and nationally had a sprinkler system that put in place where fires have occurred.
I mean, yeah, there's no question on the life-saving properties of these things. And we've just seen some pretty tragic fires just within the past few days. Today, as we're recording this, six people were killed in a fire in California. Yesterday, four more people were killed. So we really need to do something to stop this this trend of fire deaths across the country. And I think, we all know that sprinklers would just be a real good solution to that problem right there.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, when you look at, just for example, in 2005, I'm told that fire departments responded to approximately 1.6 million fires nationwide, and there were some 3,600 plus civilian deaths and over 17,000, actually almost 18,000 civilian injuries resulting from fires in the United States. And fires caused over $10.6 billion in direct property damage that year. You know, sprinklers, as I'm told, are responsible for approximately 70% reduction from fires in public assembly and educational, residential, and commercial industrial manufacturing buildings when they're in place and operational. And again, it's just a common sense thing to do, both in terms of lives that could be saved, injuries that could be prevented, and
Senator, I'd like to really thank you for being such a strong supporter of fire safety and, you know, and introducing this piece of legislation every time. And, you know, the fire service is definitely behind you on this. We all know the value of sprinklers and saving lives, not only of the civilians out there, but also the firefighters as well, because if the fires don't occur, then the firefighters don't have to go in to rescue the people. So this will be something to save not only people's lives, you know, the homeowners, the civilians, but also firefighters as well.
That's right. It's a win-win all the way around, and that's an important point to make, that, you know, our firefighters, day in and day out, put their lives on the line to protect life and property. And if there's something like this that we can put in place to make their job easier, keep them safe, as well as the civilians in these buildings, these commercial facilities, bars and nightclubs, if we can do something to keep people safe, we should do it. But it's important, as you mentioned, to point out first responders put their lives on the line every day to protect lives and property, and they deserve our thanks and also their support wherever possible.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking to Congressman Langevin from Rhode Island's 2nd Congressional District. He has introduced H.R. 1742, which is the Fire Sprinkler Incentive Act. And, Congressman, thanks a lot for taking the time. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thanks, Ed. I appreciate it. Good to talk to you, too.
All right, let's take a break here. You've been listening to the Fire Marshal's Corner on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamau.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And welcome back to Fire Marshal's Corner. This segment, we're going to be talking about the new residential sprinkler ordinance or code change that's going to be going before the ICC in Rochester, New York in May. And here to talk to us about that is Jeff Shapiro, who's both president of the International Code Consultants and heads up the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
My pleasure to be here.
Jeff, can you fill me in a little bit before we start, really, what the Fire Sprinkler Coalition is all about?
Yeah, the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition is a newly formed organization that was put together to facilitate adoption of a requirement in the International Residential Code to make fire sprinklers a standard feature in new construction, one- and two-family dwellings and townhouses. And the organization started with a request for fire service and building safety organizations to sign a resolution supporting residential fire sprinklers and one- and two-family dwellings. And we now have more than 25 states that have submitted the resolution. Several of the states have quite a number of organizations from the same state that have submitted it. And we also have additional regional groups, such as divisions of the International Association of Fire Chiefs, and some international groups, including the Society of Fire Protection Engineers and the Institute for Fire Engineering.
Oh, great. Well, it sounds like you've gotten some excellent support from the fire service and behind this thing, as you would expect with the residential sprinklers.
Yeah. Yeah, interestingly, we have building officials in this coalition as well. The New York State Building Officials Conference and the Maryland Building Officials Association both have endorsed the resolution and support the adoption of residential fire sprinkler requirements in the IRC.
Excellent. That's excellent. Well, this, you know, as we were talking about, this is a code change that is coming up in the ICC meeting that's going to be held in Rochester, New York in May. And maybe you can fill everybody in a little bit about what is going to be happening there, what this is all about, because it's creating quite a bit of buzz out there.
Yeah, it's probably the single biggest code issue. It is the single biggest code issue in my experience of more than 20 years in the model code arena, and I suspect it's probably the single biggest code issue to hit the model codes in history in terms of the amount of effort that's going into it and also the amount of opposition that we're facing. But what will happen in Rochester, there will be 1 week of public hearings that the International Code Council will go through public comments on all the international codes. As part of that, the International Residential Code will be heard on May 22nd and 23rd, and there's a public comment in on one code change, which was consolidated with quite a number of different organizations supporting this one public comment, and that's item RB 114. That is the proposal to require residential sprinklers in the IRC for all new one- and two-family dwellings and townhouses. What's going to happen at the Rochester meeting on that particular item, which I think will probably come up on May 23rd, is that the voting membership of the International Code Council will have an opportunity to overturn a committee recommendation from last September in Orlando that recommended rejection of that proposal. And I think if you look at the committee makeup for that particular committee, the International Residential Code Development Committee, it kind of explains why the proposal was rejected. That committee is made up of a combination of industry and code officials. But at the final action hearing, only code officials are permitted to vote, and those code officials have to become, firefighters as well. Firefighters and code officials have to become voting members of the International Code Council in order to be able to vote, and they have to do so not less than 10 days before the meeting. And then there will be testimony on both for and against the proposal, and the membership will have an opportunity to vote. The item will require a two-thirds majority to pass because under the ICC rules, any item that was recommended for disapproval by the Code Development Committee to be approved in any fashion has to have a two-thirds majority. And the outcome of this hopefully will be favorable. It's certainly not the end, because even if we win this issue in Rochester, there's a whole other cycle that the ICC codes go through before the 2009 codes are finalized. And my expectation is we'll be going through this again. Even if we win, the people who oppose residential sprinklers will probably propose to undo this change in the next cycle before the 2009 code is done.
And what's the kind of opposition? What's the rationale for opposing residential sprinklers and new construction?
Well, I think, as you're aware, having been around the fire arena for many, many years, there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation about fire sprinklers in general, and particularly in one- and two-family dwellings and townhouses. That ranges from people thinking that smoke activates sprinklers and that all sprinklers operate at one time, which are obviously mythical, to the things that are a little bit more saleable, that fire sprinklers will increase the cost of new home construction if they're mandated, that there are concerns about fire sprinklers leaking and false activations and mold damage. There's a cadre of various arguments that have been launched. Sprinklers can't work on wells, they won't work on a residential meter, all kinds of things that what I find is the people that are making these arguments in many cases have never seen a residential sprinkler system in a home and really don't have any idea how they work, and they point to NFPA 13D and say that it's a standard that's way too restrictive, but yet they don't even have much knowledge about a 13D system and haven't even read the standard. So I think it's a case where people have kind of decided what position they want to take, and then they kind of reach for straws to come up with arguments against fire sprinklers. But my experience, I've been spending a tremendous amount of time going around the country and doing instruction of code officials on residential sprinklers, and once you talk through these issues, you find that people drop their opposition relatively quickly in many, many cases. And to that end, there's going to be a webinar, which we're going to be broadcasting. It's tentatively scheduled for May 1st. It'll run an hour and a half, and it'll address all these issues. It's going to be hosted by Ronnie Coleman, former state fire marshal for the state of California. And we've gotten a lot of people interviewed on the topic, from homeowners to builders who support sprinklers to mayors and legislators, all of whom have very favorable experiences with residential fire sprinkler systems. And, you know, there are over 100,000 homes in the United States that have residential fire sprinklers. So there's actually a pretty good track record out there that people really aren't well aware of. And information on the video will be posted on our website, www.ircfiresprinkler.org, sometime this coming week.
And we'll certainly have a link to that as well here on firehouse.com. If you look below, you'll see a series of links that, you know, people can go to, including yours, and we'll make sure that it's up there so they can go and watch that webinar, which will be absolutely a great way to get a lot of information. We're talking about some of the opposition that's coming to this, and you've certainly gotten great support out of the fire services, as you would expect, because we all know the difference that a sprinkler can make in terms of saving lives, not only the people in the house, but also that of firefighters as well, because there's a tremendous, the fire gets knocked down before the firefighter gets there, it's there that much less at risk. The opposition that's out there, I mean, is it organized opposition, or is it just, you know, a builder-by-builder sort of thing? I mean, are there organizations coming out flat-out in opposition to this idea?
Well, the National Association of Home Builders has had a public position against residential fire sprinklers since the mid-1980s, when the first widespread ordinance in Scottsdale passed. That ordinance, to my understanding, was originally supported by the Local Builders Association, and then the National NAHB got involved and generated a lot of opposition to it. Then eventually the National took a position publicly against residential fire sprinklers. They are very organized in their opposition. I have firsthand knowledge that NAHB has committed to $250,000 minimum emergency funding to energize their local chapters around the country and motivate them to go speak to code officials and get code officials to come to the Rochester meeting and vote against residential sprinklers. So there is a very organized effort by NAHB that's being coordinated through their website, and they've provided talking points for their builders to use in opposition. And, you know, they have a much lower hurdle than we do. They only have to get a one-third plus one number in Rochester. So, they're very organized, and they're very publicly, in the past, very publicly against residential fire sprinklers.
And I do have to mention that we did invite them to be on this podcast. I'm sure it was kind of like coming into the lion's den a little bit, but we did want to give them an opportunity to give their position, but despite repeated requests, you know, they just never responded to be a part of this, because we did want to give them a chance to kind of air their view on, you know, why they are in such opposition to it.
One thing that's very important to point out, Ed, too, is that I don't, from my experience, NAHB's corporate position doesn't reflect the position of all home builders. And on the webinar that we're going to do, we've interviewed a number of home builders who are installing fire sprinkler systems and are very much in favor of residential fire sprinklers. So, you know, you can't take this to say all home builders are against fire sprinklers. I think the ones that are against it are the ones that really don't have any experience with them, that are just taking the lead from the National.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's talk a little bit about what kind of impact this will have on the future of fire safety. Do you have any idea, any numbers at all, about how many new homes are being built in the United States each year? I mean, because I think that'll give us a kind of quantify what kind of impact this will have.
Well, you know, looking at gross numbers, you see the numbers of 1.5 million new homes being built on an annual basis around the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to point out that this proposal only impacts new homes. There's no effort here to try to do a retrofit because of some of the practicality issues in trying to retrofit homes with fire sprinklers. But at some point, you have to start somewhere and say,
sure,
from today forward, we're going to require this protection, the same as you do with airbags and same as you do with vehicle anti-skid systems. You know, when at some point the government sets a mandate, and from that date forward, all new equipment, vehicles, or in this case homes, are going to have this level of protection. But in the big scheme of things, by passing this requirement in the IRC, you're not going to say starting January 1st, 2009, we're going to be sprinkling all homes in the United States. On the contrary, what it's going to happen is we'll put this in the model code, and then you'll see the regional home builders, the state chapters, probably fighting adoption of this requirement in the IRC. When the IRC gets adopted at the state-by-state and local level, they'll fight to take it out, and then, you know, the battle will go to that level. And in some places, there are hurdles that jurisdictions are going to have to overcome with regard to standby fees, with regard to labor issues and who's allowed to install these systems, that might, and certainly will in some cases, delay the ultimate adoption of this. So, you know, my sense is that when we're successful, if this going forward with the 2009 code requirement, you'll probably see that adopted starting in about 2010 in some jurisdictions, and realistically, it'll probably be 8-10 years before you see really a nationwide requirement for sprinklers, as we get experience in some jurisdictions that other jurisdictions will then look to and say that, you know, it's not such a big deal after all. And in my opinion, it really isn't nearly the big deal that it's being portrayed as. You know, the home builders objected to the installation of smoke detectors originally. They've changed their that. They objected to ground fault interrupters. They objected to arc fault interrupters. There's a cadre of safety features that have been going into the codes that the home builders have indicated that it's going to have a tremendous impact on the cost of affordable housing and new home construction. And the fact is, when these requirements go into place, there's barely a blip in the market. In fact, there isn't a blip in many cases, and home building continues as it always has. And one thing that I think is very important to point out, that the argument that is used against sprinklers that gains a lot of traction for people that don't really study the issue, is that this is going to have an impact on affordable housing. And in fact, that really isn't true. The cost of homes in the United States isn't based on how much it costs the builder to build it. It's based on what the market will bear in the sale price. And I think the reason that the home builders oppose residential sprinklers is because once they're mandated as part of the cost of construction, the top end price, what they can sell the home for, is pretty much fixed, so that they have to adjust one of two things. It either cuts into the builder's margin if the sprinklers are required, or they have to adjust what's going to be a standard feature versus something that's an option in a new home. And if sprinklers become standard, to keep the sale price of the home the same, something that's currently standard today now has to become an option to offset that cost. But it really is not true that in the majority of cases, you're not going to find the cost of the home having the impact on what the sale price is. The sale price is going to be dictated by what people will pay for the home. And that's true in affordable housing as well. We're sprinkling in Austin Habitat for Humanity homes that are 1,000, 1,200 square feet, and the cost of piping and materials and installation is roughly 50 cents a square foot on those homes. Now, that's not marked up. That's the direct cost to the builder, Habitat in this case, for the installation. And in this case, we're doing it combined with the plumbing system. It's all one. It's plumbing and sprinklers.
And there are a number of communities across the country that have ordinances right now, don't they? I mean, Scottsdale is the one that certainly comes to mind. They've had it for a long time. But there are others. I think, Prince George's County down in Maryland?
Yeah, Prince George's County has had their ordinance since the early 1990s. I think the number that they quote, I don't have it in front of me, but I think the number is over 50,000 homes that have been sprinklered in Prince George's County. Montgomery County, Maryland recently passed the requirement. I believe Charles County, Maryland now has the requirement. Maryland, as a state, has gained a tremendous amount of traction in getting sprinklers into new homes, and it's working very well there. Many jurisdictions, really across the United States, from north to south and east to west, there are communities that are putting in residential fire sprinkler systems, and they're having positive experiences. So, again, I think you find the opposition, in my opinion, tends not to be really well-informed, and they play off arguments that, from jurisdictions that have the experience of installing sprinklers, have been shown to be untrue.
Well, we've been talking to Jeff Shapiro, who's the president of International Code Consultants and heads up the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition, about the new code change that's coming into the ICC code that's going to be voted on out in Rochester, New York. What's the date on that again, Jeff?
The IRC hearing will be May 22nd and 23rd, and this item is pretty likely to be heard on the 23rd.
And people that are eligible to vote there, they can be the AHJs, the fire marshals, or anybody from the fire service. And as long as you sign up as a member 10 days prior to that, then you're eligible to vote.
And membership in ICC is really not a whole lot of money, and you get a lot of good benefits from it anyway, whether you go to the meeting to vote or not. So I strongly encourage people to join and get involved.
And you said it right there. You took the words out of my mouth. Really encourage you all to, if you're able to go, to become a member of ICC so you can voice your opinion and vote on residential fire sprinklers, which we know will make a dramatic difference for both the civilians out there, but also the firefighters as well, protecting lives and saving property. So, Jeff, we really appreciate
Any jurisdiction that wants a residential sprinkler requirement, the place to start is going to Rochester to vote this into the IRC, because it makes the local adoption in the future at your jurisdiction much, much easier to accomplish.
Well, Jeff, really appreciate you taking the time. We'll make sure that the links to the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition are on the webpage below, as well as the one to your webinar when that comes up. So You can look, people, you can look right here on the at radio@firehouse.com for those links, get more information, and hopefully we'll see you up there in Rochester, New York. Thanks a lot, Jeff, for joining us.
Thanks. I'd appreciate the opportunity.
And joining us today is John Dragenberg from Underwriters Laboratory. He's the manager of consumer affairs and an engineer with UL. And John's going to be talking to us today about the E85 dispensing systems, or more commonly known as ethanol fuel, that's starting to become more and more common across the country. And appreciate you taking the time, and welcome to Fire Marshal's Corner, John.
Ed, it's my pleasure to be here with you.
Underwriters Laboratories were writing a number of the standards that are relating to this equipment. So I was wondering if you could just maybe fill in our listeners a little bit about, you know, what it is, what E85 is, and what are some of the issues with the dispensing equipment out there in the field?
Well, Underwriters Laboratories, as you know, is that independent, not-for-profit organization that tests thousands of different products. You see the UL mark on your toaster and on your television, but also we do many different types of dispensing systems and components. And for years, of course, we've tested the gasoline dispensing systems that are used at fuel stations and of all the components that go into it. But lately, within the last several years, as you just mentioned, ethanol has become a popular alternative and is something that is being talked about very much. And what's happened in the last year is that Underwriters Laboratories received its first submittal of an E85 dispensing system. And that happened about mid-year in 2006. The manufacturer came to us and said, here is an entire ethanol dispensing system. Test it, just like you do gasoline dispensers. Well, of course, that seemed easy enough. We do that kind of thing all the time. But there is a difference between ethanol and gasoline. And I think it's pretty well known in the scientific community that ethanol is a very heavily alcohol-based fuel. It comes from the fermentation of corn. And alcohol has different properties than gasoline does. Alcohol happens to be hydroscopic, and hydroscopic materials do attract water, and there are different chemical reactions that take place. The bottom line is that ethanol fuel has a much more corrosive tendency toward soft metals and plastics than does gasoline. What that means, Ed, is that we just couldn't take our gasoline dispenser requirements, all the different tests that we do and all the different construction features that we have in place, we couldn't just take them and transfer them to ethanol dispensers. And that meant that we had to do some hard thinking on just, you know, where we go from here, what we do. Of course, our concern was, as you can imagine, that if ethanol is corrosive, what happens to the various seals and gaskets? Some of them are plastic-based. Some of them are soft metals like aluminum and brass. Will they be corroded to the extent that fuel will leak and cause a fire hazard, which is something that, of course, we're interested in, as are most of the people listening. And the other thing is that it could leak and possibly contaminate groundwater, which is a second issue. But our initial concern, of course, is fire and explosion from leaking fuel. Of course, we all know now that there are various pressures to use more fuel, such as ethanol, because it requires less fuel from overseas. And this, of course, is a very positive aspect of it. And we certainly understand that. But when we write a safety standard, of course, we always have to base it in scientific fact. So what we did was we set up a meeting. It took place late last year in 2006. We set up this meeting. We invited people who manufacture dispensers, people who make components for the dispensers, automotive manufacturers, people who build the cars, people who work with the fuels. We had 32 national experts come to a meeting. We hosted that at Underwriters Laboratories in conjunction with the Department of Energy. They were co-hosts with us. And we talked to all these people, and we said, okay, we've got to write a standard that will cover a dispenser that's going to dispense ethanol, or commonly known as E85-type fuel. The fact is that we got a lot of great information from that meeting, but most of it was anecdotal. It wasn't scientifically based. People were saying, well, we use this material and it seems to work fine and has worked fine for several years, which is probably very accurate, but we don't know if that's just the way it happened in that particular instance or if it, you know, if it was just lucky. And you can't write a safety standard on something that's lucky. And that's what UL does, of course. We write safety standards, the safety standards for most of the things in your home, especially the electrical things. Those standards are written by UL, and we also test the products. So we always do the right thing. We decided then and there that we have to look for more research, and we did that throughout the late 2006. But by the beginning of 2007, we said there just isn't enough research available to us to write a safety standard. We have to undertake our own research, which is where we stand right now. UL is running research, and we are targeting to complete that sometime early in the fourth quarter of 2007.
So I guess kind of a basic question, are there E85 dispensing systems out there right now that are actually in use?
Absolutely there are, and that's the ironic thing, or the thing that we're questioned about very often, is that we see ethanol fuel dispensers in mainly the Midwestern states. Iowa, for example, has a lot of dispensing systems that can dispense E85 fuel, and we have no reports of any incidents. There have been no fires reported, no major leaks, certainly no explosions. Nothing of that type has happened, and the question always comes back, well, why aren't you listing these dispensers? There is no history of anything happening. But the reality is, again, the scientific community understands that ethanol, E85, is alcohol-based. Alcohol is much more corrosive than gasoline, and the potential exists. That's known. It's just what isn't known is how to prevent the problem from happening. What is needed to keep those components from dissolving or deteriorating in one way or another and causing a leak? So right now, it's been you're right. There's been a lot of that going on. Not only have there been ethanol dispensers, but for years and years, ethanol has been mixed with gasoline in much smaller percentages, down to about 15% and less, 10% ethanol, to stretch the gasoline even further. And there's some statistics, I don't have them with me, but there are statistics to show just how many millions of barrels of gasoline have been saved that we did not have to import because we've used ethanol to stretch the gasoline, so to speak. So there's good valid reason for wanting to do this, but no, there have been no incidents, but yet Underwriters Laboratories does the right thing. We can't write a safety standard based on anecdotal evidence.
I don't know if you'll have the answer for this one or not, but can you quantify how much E85 is being used? Do you know how many gallons are out there in use? Do you know how many dispensing systems or anything like that to kind of give us a handle on how widespread this stuff is being used?
No, I'm afraid I don't have any of that information, but what I can tell you, Ed, is that it's growing. More and more stations are, and big box retailers are looking at installing ethanol dispensers. Most people refer to them as pumps, but to us the pump is just the motor-driven pumping device that moves the fuel. These dispensers are being installed, but right now they're not installing as many as they would like to, simply because Underwriters Laboratories doesn't have the requirements in place, and Underwriters Laboratories won't put their UL mark on these dispensers at this point. Now, we are committed that as soon as we have the requirements, as soon as we finish the research, and as soon as we evaluate the data, we will establish requirements, and we will put those requirements to work immediately testing E85 dispensers. So we're committed to doing this. We just need something to test it to. The funny thing, Ed, is if you came to us today with a toaster, we'd start the testing tomorrow because we have all kinds of requirements for toasters. Coming to us with an ethanol fuel dispenser, we don't have any requirements, and unfortunately, we can't do any testing.
And it's an entire system, right? I mean, I would assume all the way from the tank in the ground to the nozzle that goes into the vehicle. It's an entirely new system. Is that what it is?
Well, it is, although it's very similar to what we're all very accustomed to with gasoline dispensers. It's the same style, the same type, and when we talk about dispensers, we're talking mainly the equipment above ground, but it is a motorized pump. It involves nozzles and hoses and meters and valves, breakaways in case you happen to drive away with the nozzle still stuck in your gas tank filler. That kind of thing is very common to gasoline dispensers as well as ethanol dispensers. So the reality is they're very similar. They will look alike. They'll operate very much the same. It's just the type of fuel that they're pulling through the system that is what concerns the all of us at UL. I sit in a team of engineers that is working on this. This project, and I'm telling you, it's a very high priority project at UL.
Now, what about the rest of the infrastructure? I mean, the fuel has to get to the station, so I mean, you've got the delivery trucks, you know, and then wherever they're picking it up from, you know, there have to obviously be dispensing systems that are putting it into the tankers and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, is this a bigger issue than just your corner 7-Eleven or Circle K, you know, that's carrying this sort of stuff? Is it a bigger issue than that?
Well, it certainly is, and you're absolutely right. The fuel has to be manufactured, first of all, and those plants are being built at a rapid rate. There are a lot of ethanol production facilities that are now being built, and many in the planning stages. So this, as I mentioned earlier, is a growing situation. The problem with ethanol is it isn't like gasoline in one more respect, and that is that you can't just put it in a pipeline and pump it huge distances or even transport it huge distances. You have to be somewhat close to the plant that manufactures it, and I don't know all the chemistry involved in the life of ethanol, but it just doesn't last as long the way you want it if it sits for too long a period of time. And that's another interesting thing. I've been out at biofuels conferences not long ago, one in Albany, New York, and the fact is, in the eastern part of the United States, and maybe even in the far western part, ethanol is well known, and the experts there are talking about it, but it's not as common as you might find it in the upper Midwest. There, they're talking more about biodiesel, which is a fuel that is made somewhat the same way. You've got fermentation of various other products that will create a biodiesel-type fuel. So there's more than one. I mean, when we talk ethanol, that's one, but there's methanol, and there are other kinds of fuels that could be coming online, and of course the market will ultimately determine what's going to be used.
As we wrap up towards the end here, there's two things that I'd like to ask you to let our listeners know. First of all, if they do have an incident involving an ethanol dispensing system, I'm sure you folks want to hear about that. How do they do that?
Absolutely. There is always a need for input, and we have asked for that input constantly. We would like people to contact us and let us know if they've got any scientific data. We'd like to know if there are any incidents, although we keep a pretty close watch on the information that comes in through the fire protection community, and we really haven't seen any incidents. But if you have data, you can always contact Underwriters Laboratories at 847-272-8800, and we would be happy to get that information. We're even going so far, Ed, as to find stations that are going out of service after pumping ethanol for various periods of time, and we're doing what we call harvesting. We take the dispensers after they're taken out of service, and we do what I basically call an autopsy on them, just to see what's happened with the various components. Take it apart, see what's going on inside.
And is there information on your website that people can go to get additional information on this?
Absolutely. One of the main groups that we try to keep posted on what we're doing and why we're doing it is the fire protection community, the regulators, as we call them, or the authorities having jurisdiction. And there you can look at ul.com/regulators.
And we'll have links to your site, too, on the webpage here, so the listeners can just take a look down, scroll down here on the webpage, and you'll find links to UL, or you can just go to that website that John just told you about. Well, John, I know it's a complex issue, and I wish we had more time to really get into it because I'm sure there's so much more on it. But we really do appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the Fire Marshal's Corner and fill us in on the issues involving the E85 dispensing equipment issues, which is just a growing and growing problem across the country.
Well, we hope we're a part of the solution to the problem, and we are really, as I mentioned earlier, putting this as a high priority. We plan to have our research done by the fourth quarter of 2007, and out of that will result in standards that can be followed by the manufacturers of the dispensers. We are committed to testing those dispensers as soon as we can, and that will probably unplug the log jam, and many retailers, many service stations will install dispensers because there is a desire by the public to have alternative fuel, and we understand that completely.
All right, great. Well, we've been listening to John Dragenberg, who's a manager of consumer affairs and an engineer with Underwriters Laboratories.
And I'm here with Sean Longrich, who is the executive director of the People's Burn Foundation. And Sean has been working on an excellent program that I learned about recently called To Hell and Back, which is to educate firefighters and the public about burn injuries and burn prevention. And with that, I'd like to ask Sean to first give us a little bit of information about the People's Burn Foundation and then a little bit more about the program.
Well, the People's Burn Foundation was started about 10 years ago by a woman who lost two children in a fire, residential fire, left her and her eldest daughter burn survivors. I met Bella not long after the fire, and fortunately she took a tragedy and turned it into something positive, and that idea was to build a foundation that could specifically serve burn survivors with very specific needs. That's the way it started anyway, 10 years ago, but now we've moved on to more of a prevention mission, although we have a dual mission, and that's to serve our burn survivors and to prevent burn injuries. Burn prevention, because of the escalating trend in burn statistics, has become a primary goal for the foundation. And in line with that, we developed a program called To Hell and Back. And To Hell and Back, in and of itself, the development of that is interesting because it took two tragedies, one, the Seton Hall tragedy, and another local tragedy. It was a truck explosion on our interstate. And the way that that came together is very interesting. We had an NBC anchor that was in the audience the night that Matt Rainey presented his After the Fire presentation. And if you know about that, that was Matt won a Pulitzer Prize for that photo documentary that he did when he followed two students that had been tragically burned in the Seton Hall fire.
And for those people that may not remember it, Seton Hall happened in 2000, and it was a fire at a dorm where three students were killed and a number of students were injured. So that's the fire that Sean is talking about that the reporters followed. So sorry to interrupt there, Sean. But
that's okay. It's a good background. And so Anne being in the audience and being affiliated with the foundation was just really taken with that whole presentation. And she said, Sean, for the first time, I think I know what it is we're trying to prevent. Well, fast forward a year, and we had this horrific explosion on our interstate. It was a box truck. There were 13 painters trapped in the box truck. And somebody flicked a lighter. And obviously, there was just a horrific explosion. 13 painters severely burned. Two died. And the day that that happened, Ann called and she said, Sean, this is an opportunity to pick up where Matt Rainey left off. You know, we had just opened a new burn center here. It was an opportunity to showcase what we were able to do with burn injuries. And it was furthermore and primarily an opportunity to help the public understand what a burn injury is. And so with that, they invested a year and they followed four of the painters through the recovery process of a severe burn injury and created a phenomenal documentary called To Hell and Back. When it was done and over, Ann said, you know, I want you to look at it and see what you think. And I said, Ann, this can't go back on the shelf. You know, we've got to be able to use this as a tool somehow. And so after the documentary aired and won several national awards, I went and asked if I could have a copy, just a preview, and see if there was any way that we could use it. And I had questions at the time about whether or not we could use it with community, because it is a graphic documentary. So through the process, I thought, you know, firefighters are our largest demographic that are intentionally exposed to burn injuries. So let's see what they think about it. So interestingly, I took the documentary to firefighters, not trainers and nobody in the administration, and I said, you know, watch this with me and see what you think. See if you think that it would change your job. And they all looked at me when it was done and said, no, this wouldn't change the way I do anything. I'm supposed to go in and save people, and I'm supposed to fight fire. Well, as I was walking out, I ran into the director of training for the Indianapolis Fire Department, and I said, would you watch this with me for a minute and see what you think? Well, they got into it for 5 minutes, and I'm like, can we use this with our current recruit class? And so with that, in walks the director of EMS, and he says, what are you watching? And so he starts watching it, and he said, my gosh, we could use this for to teach our EMTs about pre-hospital treatment of the burn patient. They never understand. We've never had a tool. So we sat and discussed it for a while, and I took it then to union officials and several other organizations within the fire service. And all of those that teach firefighters said, we need this. So we took some of those trainers and we put together a national team, and we decided to apply for an AFG grant, an Assistance to Firefighters grant through Homeland Security. And we got the grant, $500,000 grant, and so the team went to work. And what they did was they built around that documentary a burn prevention program for firefighters, and they tied it to firefighters by interviewing firefighters that had been burned in the line of duty that could say, it doesn't make any difference if you're a painter, a fire, a doctor, a lawyer, or an Indian chief. This is the reality of a burn injury. And through that, and obviously including the OSHA standards and NFPA standards and talking about PPE and helping them understand, you know, how the skin protects the body, much like PPE protects their body, we were able to create a very successful program. It was launched last year at FDIC and distributed to 38,000 fire departments throughout the United States. So
you mentioned you pulled the team together, Sean. Who did you have on that team?
On the team are still to this day Don Abbott. He's the director of training with the Phoenix Fire Department. Rob Schnepp, who is now the assistant chief for the Alameda County, California Fire Department. Tom Dement, who is with the Poudre Fire Authority out in Denver, Colorado. Sean Grass, who's the division chief of training for Warren Township Fire Department locally and also a volunteer firefighter. Steve Alk, who's the division chief of training, or the division chief of EMS for the Indianapolis Fire Department. Dr. Mike Olinger, who is their medical director. And I think that about sums it up for the first round.
So, I mean, obviously a pretty strong fire service representation in helping you put this together.
Absolutely. I mean, they put the program together. They wrote the program for their own. The only thing that the Burn Foundation did was really act as a conduit in terms of getting it out there and getting a free program out there that was readily accessible. Because as I learned through that team, you know, there are thousands of programs that are out there, but on a grassroots level, they're very tough to access. So literally putting it in their hands made it successful, and it's changed. We know that it's changed behavior, and that was the goal of the program.
So it's been out there about, what, a year now, I guess?
Almost a year. It'll be a year in April.
So what's happened in that year?
Well, I know that it has been certified for continuing education credits in 5 states. I know that several departments, and I don't have their permission to say who they are, otherwise I would be spouting them, have said that it is now mandatory training in their training programs for new recruits. And I did receive word yesterday that on a regional level, Arizona has now said that it is going to, effective 2008, January of 08, it is mandatory for Firefighter 1, Fire Officer 1, and Safety Officer 1 curriculums, and then to Helen Back 2, which we are getting ready to launch, that's for situational awareness, and we are only pilot site testing that, but they used it out in Arizona. They went ahead and accepted that into Firefighter 2, Fire Officer 1, and Safety Officer 4 Firefighter 2 classes. So it's now mandatory in the state of Arizona.
Oh, that's excellent. You've had some excellent progress on that.
Yeah.
What's been some of the feedback? What, I mean, kind of kind of anecdotally, what have you heard people saying about it?
Well, there's one that I remember more than anything else, and it was a volunteer firefighter in the northern part of the United States who's 78 years old, and one of the firefighters on his squad wrote in and said, you know, I've noticed a firefighter who's 78 years old after we went through the Tahoe and Back program, I noticed him wearing his turnout gear, and I said, Chief, why is it that you all of a sudden started wearing your turnout gear? And he said, well, I saw that to Hell and Back thing, and I was afraid I was going to have to run into a building and pull one of you kids out. So, but that's one of, you know, 10,000 responses that we've received, all very, very positive. And, in fact, Canada picked it up, and actually they previewed, there were several Canadian firefighters that previewed the program at FDIC, and we received a call right before we went, we did the distribution, and as it turned out, Canada ordered 2,500 copies for all of their fire departments throughout Canada.
You'd mentioned To Hell and Back, too. Can you talk just briefly about that, what that program is?
Yeah, To Hell and Back, too, is all about situational awareness. Through the feedback, many of the firefighters said, he dropped us. We want more. We need more situational awareness training. So in that particular program, excuse me, Billy Goldfeder hopped on board, and he said the way that we need to teach firefighters is through the reality of devastating circumstances and situations where we had bad turnouts. So we brought together five or six firefighters, chiefs, and trainers that had been involved in incidents in which there had been very serious burn injuries or deaths. And those firefighters were interviewed. And then as they are interviewed, what we did was we created 3D graphics that literally turn the lights on in that scenario and show firefighters where situations went south and how they went south. And then Billy Goldfeder summarizes with all of the points that are necessary, you know, once again, reciting all of the NFPA, OSHA standards, risk versus loss benefits, rural water supplies, wildland fire, whatever the situation pertains to, Billy summarizes all of that at the end. So we call that program To Hell and Back, too.
Oh, and you can't get a better stamp of approval than Billy Goldfeder, because he is just so much into firefighter safety and firefighter awareness that, you know, and for him to lend his credence to a program like this really says a lot about it.
Well, absolutely, and he hopped on this team with absolute, I mean, he just said, absolutely, yes, I will. And he talks about this program all over the country. And so that obviously helps keep the program out there for those departments that, for some reason or another, didn't get their hand on it.
Okay, and you mentioned the department that might not have their hands on it. If somebody wanted to get this program, what would they do?
All they have to do is call the foundation. Call us at 877-814-2024. Or you can go to our website at peoplesburnfoundation.org, click on To Hell and Back, and send us an email and say, I want a copy. It's free. We'll send it to you. There are instructor outlines online with all of the pre- and the post-testing evaluations and resources that you could possibly need. It is a turnkey program, so you don't need an instructor, but if you want to turn it into an instructor-driven class, all of the materials are there to do that.
And this is all done with the Department of Homeland Fire Prevention grant, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Every last bit of it.
Well, that's great. I mean, it's one of the really positive things that has come out of that program. Well, a lot of positive things have come out of that program. But here's certainly one that I think is, and especially like you said, it's a turnkey operation, so they can get everything they need right there in a package to get some really excellent training. I've seen this program myself, and compelling is just one of the words that comes to mind. I just sat there riveted watching this whole thing. It's just, you guys did an absolutely excellent job on that, Sean.
Thank you very much.
Job on that. Yep. If you want more information, you can go to the People's Burn Foundation, or you can click on one of the links below on the page here, and it'll give you some more information and take you there as well. But, Sean, we'd really like to thank you for, you know, being so proactive in terms of trying to eliminate firefighter injuries through just greater awareness, you know, bring it to their attention, giving them better training. I think this program is just a fantastic one. I think you've done a wonderful job.
Thanks, Ed. We're just going to, as you say, keep chipping away.
Okay. Well, we're speaking with Sean Longrich, who's the executive director of the People's Burn Foundation, about their program, To Hell and Back. And if you're looking for more information on that, what's the phone number again, Sean?
877-814-2024.
Or you can click on one of the links below on the page here, and it'll take you to the People's Burn Foundation. And, you know, you can get your own copy of To Hell and Back if you don't already have it in your department to use to try to improve and eliminate the issues of firefighters being burned in fires or even firefighter deaths, hopefully. So with that, thank you very much, Sean. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much, Ed. It was a privilege.
Well, that was a really pretty incredible show that we had there today. A lot of people with a lot of great information. If you look down below on the page here, you'll find links to a number of sites that will give you more detailed information. And also, we're always interested in what you think and what you hear and what you know. And so there's an email link down below where you can send us information or post your comments about this show. So thanks for listening to Fire Marshal's Corner at radio@firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamau, and we'll see you next month.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.